Friday, everybody. Welcome to The Information's 411, your weekly podcast from theinformation.com, a news site that covers the tech industry. My name is Tom Dotun. I'm a reporter at The Information. Two segments in today's episode. First, I'm talking to Amir Efrati, who wrote a story about, it was a data point, one of our famed data points, about self-driving cars and the amount invested in that technology over the last decade. It's a lot. $16 billion, more than that, actually. And Amir and I break down all the different investors, the big companies that have spent the most trying to bring this technology to the real world, why we are still so far away from it really being a thing that you and I could use in our daily lives, and why we did not include Tesla in that chart. Big point of controversy on Twitter. So Amir gives his explanation for the world to hear why Twitter was not included in our self-driving investment technology chart. And then I'm talking to Kate Clark, who wrote a story about Sequoia and how that fund has expanded its number of partners who do seed investing. And it gives us an opportunity to look into why seed investments as a category has gotten so competitive, why the big funds like Sequoia want to spend more in it, and what that means for the smaller funds that were seed focused. Do you want to make one quick plug here before we start the show? As a reminder, we have our upcoming WTF Women's Summit in New York on May 12th. You can find more information and a link to purchase tickets at theinformation.com/events. We also, I want to thank our inaugural sponsor, RBC, the Royal Bank of Canada, for supporting this year-long program, which includes a quarterly newsletter, cocktail parties, mentorship groups, and more. All right, let's get to my talk with Amir. Amir, you have this story that is a data point, so one of our data-intensive charts.
But so much more.
Right. And the reason it was more than just a data point is it was truly an opportunity to dig into the state of self-driving car technology right now and where the top companies that are financing it, where they are, kind of what's the, how much progress have they made? How realistic is it, you know, however many years into this whole thing? And so, I mean, to give the article, you know, its headline a bit of time, you charted out how much has been spent on self-driving car technologies the last few years, and the number you arrived at was $16 billion.
A minimum.
At least $16
billion. Right, and this is investment in a fully self-driving car, like a robo-taxi, like an automated taxi.
Like no driver, not an
assistant. Driverless okay. Taxi, basically.
Yeah. Right, and that's the promise, right? That's what Waymo, that's what Uber, that's what Cruise.
Yeah.
And so it seems like there's a bit of a, you know, the 99% are the rest, but there's the 1%, you know, it's really just the top three control like a huge percentage or
of the spend,
responsible for a huge percentage of the spend. So that's Waymo, that's Cruise, and that's Uber.
Yeah. And these are pretty substantial organizations now. Cruise is like 1,700 employees. Waymo's like 1,400 employees, like 1,000 engineers. Cruise probably has more than 1,000 engineers. These are huge cost centers, and they are kind of operating on the assumption that they'll be able to, you know, create a business out of technology that doesn't exist yet. And it's you know, it's a gamble. I'm glad somebody's taking it. Lord knows we need more auto safety, but the modern car is getting a lot safer already. You have automatic emergency braking and other collision warnings, and blind spot warnings, things like that, that are making drivers a lot safer, making them better. And what we're going to have to do is measure the fully self-driving technology against that new standard. And it's going to make it a lot harder to kind of prove that, you know, these efforts, whether from Waymo or Cruise or Uber or any of the others working on it, Zooks, Aurora, we have a long list there, that they're actually safer than a human driver. So I think progress is being made. We know that it is. Internally, these companies are reporting progress. They're certainly not reporting it externally. And there's a big debate now about how to measure safety, how these companies should publicly report safety. And it's a discussion we're going to have because there's no great answer right now. We've written a lot about this topic, especially as it relates to Cruise. But really, you know, the thing that actually came out of this story was What is the state of the art self-driving tech?
Right, right. And that's why I thought the top three companies that you have listed there, which have invested the most in it, were a good place to start, because they each have different incentives for wanting to have self-driving technology exist in the world. Uber's, I understand, and we'll get to them in a bit, but Waymo has been at this for longer than anyone, right? Why is it of interest to Alphabet to invest more than anybody, or it's so important to them that they are willing to invest more than anyone to make this work?
Well, Alphabet has like infinity cash, so you know, chump change for them to spend $3 or $4 billion over a decade on something like this. But now Waymo is a like $1 billion a year cost center almost, so it's going to be, you know, needing to show some progress. So they are going to have to make some changes, I think, in the near future. They tried to get some outside investors to start shouldering some of the costs, but because of the valuation they were asking for, at least last year, they weren't able to get that. Waymo, I mean, you know, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, when they were still around, they were very passionate about
it. They're still involved. Still alive. Yeah. Sure.
Still around the company. You know, they were very, very interested in this topic because, I mean, it's a topic anyone can get around. Like who doesn't know somebody who's been in a car wreck, right? If you haven't been in a major one yourself. And so when you can show that like a good percentage of the time, you know, the vehicle can like see more around it than a human can, you know, you just sort of start to believe in this idea that it is possible. It's possible. So, you know, so they have a lot of like well-meaning reasons for doing this. And they also think it's going to be a gigantic business.
Sure.
If and when it's around.
It's a long-term investment.
So the thing that, you know, they've done a lot of marketing, Waymo has, around its state-of-the-art prototypes. And, you know, everyone kind of agrees that they do have the quote-unquote best or safest or most advanced technology. But, you know, there's still, this is a really huge cost to operate this, because even the most advanced prototypes that Waymo has, which are these driverless vans with nobody in the car except for the passenger, when there is a passenger, it still costs a lot, because you have to have a individual human sitting in an office monitoring from afar every move that each of these vehicles is making. And they don't do that many driverless rides a day. It's like, you know, several. They want to ramp it up. And then on the other side, on the ground, they actually have a chase van.
Right.
This is kind of following behind this driverless van in case it gets stuck and the person who's monitoring it from the office can't help. So this is a really, really huge cost to do this. And they're doing this out of an abundance of caution. They don't want to make a mistake.
Sure. We've seen what happens when things go catastrophically wrong.
Uber's a good example of that. Yeah. So the other thing that we mentioned in the story is about Apple, mm-hmm. which is the most mysterious of all of the entrants here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure they still have ambitions to design a car from the ground up. That is an incredibly ambitious undertaking. And for a while, they're working very hard on it, trying to do just that, and also to develop their own sensors and very expensive things in the hardware world that they know how to do for other consumer electronics. Cars are much more complex. So they scaled that down. However, they do have a very experienced vehicle engineering person named Doug Field, who was at Tesla previously. They have Jamie Wado, who came from Waymo as a systems engineering leader, who sort of tries to pull the hardware and software together and decide, you know, when it can go out onto the street. And they have been doing demos for years,
right,
for the executives at Apple, showing where they are.
To prove that they should still merit the investment that Apple would need to make yearly. But here's my question. If Apple is not going to be the leader in this space in terms of the amount of investment and clearly technology, why bother with them? I mean, they're not going to, you know, strike gold by doing this in 10th place or whatever it is on your list. I mean, why for them do they think it's worth continuing to make even any level of investment for a technology that they're just not going to be able to achieve?
Well, I think probably a few reasons for that. One is that you know, Apple has no problems being second or third or fourth to something as long as they do it better than anyone else or more simply than anyone else, certainly in the phone space. And I think that this is a important enough category with enough investment happening globally that they want to have kind of a stake in it in case it becomes a really big deal. And the third thing is that, you know, we're talking about a lot of applied machine learning that's happening to various parts of the software stack. And, you know, when you have people who are machine learning practitioners, if it doesn't work out, you can throw them at different problems, right? There are other ways to use people who work on computer vision challenges. And I think that you have all these technical minds in this organization that can then go on and do other things for Apple. And in fact, they have already. Right. They actually redistributed some of the headcount for this Project Titan group to other parts of Apple. Another name we haven't talked about is Aptiv, which is a car parts supplier that actually has a pretty substantial investment in this space. There are all kinds of players here, car makers, car parts suppliers.
Right, right, yeah. So that's, I mean, is there any advantage that, so number two on your chart was Cruise, which is mostly owned by GM or entirely owned by GM?
Not entirely, but mostly, yeah.
Yeah. Is there any advantage that a GM-led project would have over a tech company's, just given that they are?
Yeah. Yes, there is. I think there's an argument to be made that there's a better path to scaling the manufacturing of a driverless vehicle, kind of a purpose-built special driverless vehicle with no steering wheel, that's made to do just this sort of robo-taxi. And however, the software needs to be good for that to matter.
Right.
And I think everyone's sort of waiting for the software to get there.
Yeah.
One company we haven't talked about that we should is Tesla.
Yeah, I was saving them to the end because they're it's just a treat, a little delicacy, a little Turkish delight.
One more thing.
At the end. Yeah. Okay, so Tesla is not on your chart. This enraged me. I felt like I should have tweeted at you 5,000 times from all my different bot accounts to ensure that you knew that Tesla was a major oversight here. So what were you thinking? Why did you not include Tesla?
Well, we referenced Tesla in this piece, and we actually gave an estimated figure for their spending in this space with their relatively lean team, which we've written about in detail in the past. You can even see their org chart from like a year or so ago for the entire Autopilot group.
At theinformation.com.
Yes. So they are first and foremost developing a driver assistance system. Okay. It is, you know, automatic emergency braking. It is like assisting you in like driving correctly on the freeway.
It keeps you in your lane.
Keeps you in your lane. Sometimes drives for you as long as you keep your finger on the wheel or don't.
Please
keep your finger
on the wheel.
Yeah, keep your hands on the wheel. You know, Elon has great ambitions. He's talked a lot about full self-driving capabilities and that functionality is going to be, you know, available starting as soon as this year. But he's never really specific about what he means by that. But even if
I thought he said driveway to driveway.
Yeah. Well, even
driveway to parking lot.
Even if he, you know, the thing about Autopilot and Tesla is this is an imperfect system. It's a system that makes mistakes. And then the human is required to make up for those mistakes and like not steer into a concrete wall, for instance, or not steer into the back of
a
cruiser, you know, a patrol, you know, cruiser that's stopped in the middle of the highway, which sometimes happens more than you think. So this is what's known as a level two system. It's a system that's a driver assistance system, but the driver is responsible. They have always been developing a system where the driver is ultimately responsible for the safety of the vehicle. For them to really be in the same category as these other developers are doing things in a completely different way. They're saying, we're not going to let the passenger of this vehicle be responsible for the safety. We are going to be responsible for the safety. Just like Uber is responsible for your safety or Lyft is responsible for your safety when you get in one of those things. With Tesla, you know, I don't know that there's really any indication. Elon can talk all he wants, and it's fine. He achieves great things, but
don't doubt his vibe.
It's a huge stretch for him to just take responsibility for this system that we know is imperfect and is out there. So we're going to be seeing is he's going to kind of unleash Autopilot for city streets to try to like recognize stop signs and stoplights and maybe take turns automatically, things like that. When you put in, you know, a path or a address that you want to get to. And I'm really, really curious to see how that goes. It's been a very difficult road, no pun intended, for them to adapt autopilot, which is made for freeways, to a city street system. But they're working on it, and they have this sort of, you know, even people on the autopilot team, you know, they buy into this vision, but they usually have different timelines than Elon does. So they'll say, okay, yeah, in the future, maybe we'll have like a giant neural network that can figure out how to get us from any point A to any point B and write its own software and really be, you know, the kind of AI we want it to be. But right now, we're just trying to figure out some basic stuff. And I don't see any reason, given that autopilot is already very successful in marketing, you know, Tesla vehicles and selling Tesla vehicles, there's no reason for Tesla to suddenly take a enormous liability of saying, okay, when you turn on autopilot, it's on us.
Right.
It's not on you. It's on us. That right. is such a leap. And so, you know, it's fine. I get hazed on Twitter for this, you know, even among subscribers who are Tesla shareholders or Tesla enthusiasts or just supporters of the vision.
But your argument is that definitionally what they're doing is something different, and you can argue for its merits and whatever he's achieved. But when you're talking about self-driving technology as it relates to these other companies, it's just something else.
It's different. Yeah, yeah. It's different. And, okay. and yeah, anyway.
Yeah. No, look, this is all interesting stuff. And I think, I don't know, we'll see how the city streets thing goes, because sounds cool, but it also sounds like something different.
Keep your hands on the wheel.
Yes.
No matter what Elon says, keep yes. your hands on the wheel.
If I could offer you one thing. All right. Thank you, Amir.
Thank you.
So, Kate, your story was about Sequoia and their expansion of their seed investing team, but the story also gave a broader look at the competitiveness of seed investing these days and this sort of dichotomy between dedicated seed funds and mega funds that have seed arms and growth arms. But let's start off with Sequoia. So what is it that you uncovered, or what is it the news that you broke here about Sequoia and their seed team?
Yeah, so Sequoia's hired 4 new partners for its seed team, which brings the total, I think it's to 14. So it was a big jump. Venture capital firms don't typically hire 4 partners at once. It's a little confusing in Sequoia's case because they actually call all their investors partners.
Right.
Some of them are more like general partners, which means they get more carry in the fund, and some of them are more like principals or associates.
Okay, and these ones that they hired here, which are they?
I think it's a combination. Again, okay. They won't tell you anything, so it's really difficult to know. But just given the experience that these people have, I think it's about 50-50 split between gotcha. Some higher-level partners and some lower-level deal-makers.
Yeah, okay. So I think of Sequoia as a company that does a lot of things, but certainly growth stage. I mean, like, they have a lot of funds. Can you run down for me what their funds are?
Yeah, they have a $8 billion global growth fund, which I think is the one that's gotten the most press and has gotten the most attention just because it was one of the largest funds ever, I think only maybe below SoftBank, and obviously the Vision Fund is its own,
yeah.
is in a class of its own. But Sequoia's $8 billion fund is massive. They also have, I think it's a $1 billion venture fund. They have an even larger U.S. growth fund. They have a $180 million seed fund, which is kind of what I was focusing on in this
right.
story.
Right. And that seems to be an area of increasing focus for them. I mean, why do they feel like they needed to bulk up their seed team?
Yeah. So Sequoia will say that this isn't an area of increasing focus. But if you look at the pace of their seed deals and the fact that they've hired 4 new partners, I think you can kind of infer that they are doubling down a bit on the seed stage. I think that's because when you look at growth deals or even like Series B or even Series A rounds, they're getting a lot more competitive, which means it's really difficult for even the best venture capital funds to get in the deals. So a lot of
why though? I mean, I would think if you're Sequoia, the brand name is sterling.
Right.
Couldn't they just get access to any seed deal they wanted?
So yes, when it comes to seed deals, they absolutely can get access. And I think they probably wipe out pretty much all other competing funds, with the exception of some of these other ones that have amazing brands.
Yeah, benchmark, sure.
Right. But when it comes to later stage, it's harder to get in. So Sequoia, and Sequoia is not the only fund with this strategy, but I think if you go really early, you can get in. You get stakes early. They're worth a lot, of course, later on if you're successful.
Sure.
And you're able to bypass competition that comes at the later stage.
Right, right. And do you think Sequoia felt that they were being crowded out on the later stage, that they needed to have more boots on the ground for the early?
I don't know. I think what Sequoia is focusing on is – is the fact, yes, more boots on the ground early, because seed stage has gotten so much more competitive. There's a lot more capital in the market right now than there has really been in any other year. And that you see the impacts of that at all stages. There's a lot of new funds too cropping up at the seed stage, at the Series A. And I think Sequoia is looking at the market and realizing if we prepare by expanding our team, getting more boots on the ground, we can stay on top. I don't think Sequoia is threatened. I don't think their brand is threatened.
Yeah, it'd be hard to believe something like that. So, but from outside just Sequoia, what's going on with the seed stage environment right now? Like, you have these funds like Cowboy Ventures, mm-hmm. and other smaller dedicated seed funds, yes. that I would imagine there's some competitive issues for them, given that you have these mega funds, mm-hmm. like Sequoia, crowding in as much as they can on that stage.
I think a couple of things are happening. One, with Sequoia and other large funds getting in on seed deals, the size of seed deals has expanded a lot since maybe 2017. I think, you know, you see seed deals as large as like 6 million when historically they were less than a million.
Sure.
And as a result of growing seed deals, you see a new class of investing come up, which is pre-seed. So now there's actual dedicated pre-seed venture capital funds that will invest maybe $1 million, maybe $500,000, maybe even $2 million. And then that company will go on to raise a seed round, which is actually a lot more like a Series A. So I think what you're seeing is a shift
sure.
across the board.
Yeah. What is really behind that, though? Is it just there's so much money in the markets that if you're a company, why not ask for more?
I think two things. And I think, yes, mostly. I think it's the fact that there's so much capital in the markets. But some people will say it's because companies are actually raising money later. And there is some data that shows that companies are actually more like 3 years old before they raise their first institutional round. And that's because of AWS and other things that have allowed companies to build entire companies with very little money, because it's actually a lot cheaper to get a company off the ground with these new services.
Yeah. So what do you think happens, though, to the smaller funds that were dedicated to the seed ones?
I think that they have to do a few things. I think they have to specialize. They need to be like, okay, we're going to invest in the future of work only. Like, I've seen new funds come up that are focused on verticals like that, or you'll see, you know, we're going to do this very specific slice of enterprise SaaS. You're going to see less, and I think we already are seeing less, generalists at that stage, because you have to show the startup that if you partner with me, I will offer you more than Sequoia, because I'm an expert at what you're doing,
right.
and I can give you that. So I think there's that, and there's also the expansion of resources. Sequoia will mostly wipe out others when it comes to resources. They have, you know, and similar to Andreessen Horowitz, they have a full-time staff of people who can essentially be used as outsourced.
Full-service fund,
outsourced,
right?
Operations. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I think you'll see maybe seed funds trying to do that. I think it's going to be difficult. They obviously have less to work with. And some of these smaller funds are kind of like startups in themselves.
Right. And the likelihood that they could kind of pull a reverse Sequoia or something and say, actually, let's raise money and be a growth fund as well. Is that an option?
I think no, it's not an option. I mean, there may be a handful of funds who could raise larger. I have seen a handful of seed funds raise like $200 million funds because they're going to follow on with their best companies. They're going to keep investing. And that's one strategy of making sure that you're keeping up your stake in your best bets. But overall, no, I don't really think it's much of an option to go the other direction unless you are a Sequoia, which, you know.
Right.
There's only one.
All right, Kate. Good job. Thanks.
Thanks.